Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. It has been translated into 44 languages and has sold 22 million copies worldwide. What is it? No, not Harry Potter, nor Dan Brown. It's Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy. We'll be looking at the family fallout surrounding the 50-year-old Swedish author who died just as his books were published. We'll take a look at a poet who, according to an unusually bullish report in this week's Saturday Review, is sure to dominate the next round of poetry prizes. But we begin today's programme with a day in the death of the ageing Leo Tolstoy.
The world's greatest living writer.
Well, you all think he's Christ, don't you?
I do believe he's one of the prophets.
This is unbearable. I'm surrounded by morons.
Is planning his legacy.
Your works are the birthright of the Russian people.
I cannot stand by while they steal my children's inheritance.
I need to know anything the Countess says. She's very, very dangerous.
A clip from The Last Station, a biopic covering Leo Tolstoy's last year, which has won two Oscar nominations for Christopher Plummer and Helen Mirren, and hits the cinemas this week. The film's based on a novel by Jay Perini, who flew into London recently for a special screening and took time out to speak to Sarah Crown about it. Sarah began by asking him what it was about the dying Tolstoy that was so fascinating to him.
You know, I started this book in 1985, 1986, and I'd been reading biographies of Tolstoy, and I'd been obsessed by Tolstoy and his work for probably 20 years already. And I suddenly realized that the last year of his life was an extraordinary chrysalis. Everything could be seen, his whole life, everything he was coming apart before his eyes. He was torn by his disciples in one direction, by his wife and family in another direction. All the values that he had been upholding in these essays in his late career, everything was on the line.
Because we think of him as a fiction writer, but...
Yeah, but he became a kind of a wild-eyed prophet. After War and Peace and Anna Karenina, he basically became a guru, and thousands of people around the world became Tolstoyans. Communities were set up, Tolstoyan communities, and he was their Jesus Christ. He was the figure. In fact, he took the four Gospels, and he wrote a book called The Four Gospels, Harmonized and Restored, and he took out all the supernatural bits. So he crossed out the bit where Jesus walks on water and where he turns water into wine. That was all canceled. So he in a sense, became Christ, Tolstoy. And then I came upon the diary of the young man whom he hired to help him in his last year, Valentin Bulgakov. And when I read that and I saw that everybody else was keeping a diary, I thought, oh my word, this would make a fabulous book, a way into Tolstoy.
And so, yeah, in your novel, one of the things that I found so interesting about it was the sort of the kaleidoscopic nature of its vision. So you have all of these different people, Bulgakov and Tolstoy's wife, Sofia, and Chertkov, his disciple, all seeing him and imagining him and projecting onto this blank canvas of Tolstoy, who sort of sits in the middle of the novel, at the heart of the novel, but you never really quite see it from his perspective.
That's right. Tolstoy is the blank center of the novel. And everybody is projecting all of their own dreams, visions, paranoias onto him. So he's just a giant screen walking around, and everybody's bouncing off that screen. Whereas I have everybody else speaking in my fictional version of their voice, I never have Tolstoy say anything in the book that somebody hasn't recorded him as saying. And any time Tolstoy speaks, it's actually excerpts from his own writing.
And you mentioned then about the diaries that everyone was keeping.
Yes.
And this much of it's made of this in the film as well. You see everyone scribbling quietly. And in particular, Tolstoy's doctor, who writes down everything he says sort of in real time, I guess kind of like people on Twitter today.
That's it.
Is this a real representation of what would have been happening? Were they all absolutely compulsive diary
keepers? They were all compulsive diarists. And diaries were like Facebook in those days for these people because they read each other's diaries as well. And they recorded everything, their minute fluctuations of feeling, how they felt about each other. They left the diaries around so people could read them. Tolstoy actually kept simultaneously three diaries. He had one sort of public diary on his desk that anybody could read. He had a semi-private diary, which he kept in a drawer. And he had a really private diary, which he kept in his sock.
And so what did that mean for you then as an author? When you were writing the book, you must have read all of these diaries. They're presumably still around to be read.
Oh, sure.
And does that make this then closer to a sort of a biography, or is it a novel in your view?
Well, you know, I read the diaries, say, of Sophia, and then I made it up. I never used really her own words. I invented several characters. For instance, the girl Masha, who's the love interest for Valentin Bulgakov. That's just a piece of fiction. So it's, you know, fiction, remember the word comes from the Latin word fictio, which just means shaping. And so all a novelist does is take the facts, which alone are nothing, and puts them in a certain order and gives them a shape. And I tried to make a palpable narrative out of this. I want it to be kaleidoscopic and to show all the many facets of Tolstoy in his circle, in this dramatic last year of his life, building up to the climactic flight from home and his death in the railway station.
Could you just tell us a little bit about that? Because that's so fascinating that this was the way he chose to end his life.
Well, Tolstoy knew that in the end of the day, a lot of sort of gurus in India or in the Far East would simply take to the road. You say, enough of my worldly possessions. I've had a house and a wife and children and money and cups of tea. And it's time I put on my robe and went off on the road and begged money and sort of died as a saint. And Tolstoy liked this idea. And his wife had frankly driven him mad. And even his disciples had driven him mad. Everybody was driving him mad. So he woke up one morning at 5 a.m. and he said, that's it. I'm out of here. I'm going to go wandering. He wasn't even sure where he was going, and he only died 10 days later because he got very ill on the journey. And, of course, being Tolstoy, his great tenets were chastity was one important thing. He said nobody should ever have sexual intercourse. He believed in poverty.
He's the father of 13 children.
That's it. Father of 13 children who had about 1,000 affairs with serfs. And, you know, he was really crazy that way. And even later on in life, he was still, you know, going around with serfs now and then. He believed in vegetarian. At least he held to his vegetarianism at the end. But also, but he wasn't very good at poverty, really.
No.
I mean, he was a man who preached absolute poverty the last 30 years of his life, yet he lived in a grand estate, 4,000-acre estate with 30 servants and personal servants. He had his own personal doctor who was never more than 20 feet from his elbow. So when he goes on the road, he takes his doctor with him, and he pretty soon accumulates his entourage, and he dies thinking he's just there alone in the railway station with his best friends around him, whereas 200 reporters had appeared from all over the world and set up press tents and Dr. Makovitsky was giving regular press briefings about the great man's health. And, you know, you could pick up your New York Times and read how Tolstoy was doing that day as he was dying in the railway station. And so the title, The Last Station, refers to Ostapovo, the railway station where Tolstoy died. And it refers to the last station of the cross, which is, of course, death.
And the bit of the end of his life was one of the bits of the film that I liked the best. This image of the railway station, the doctor standing on a box outside, and all the journalists camped around the edge of it. What was it like seeing your words adapted for the film? Were you happy with the way it had turned out?
You know, many of my novelist friends have had films turned into books turned into films, and almost to a person, they're unhappy with what happened. I'm delighted. I'm thrilled. I mean, Michael Hoffman and this gang of Helen Mirren and Paul Giamatti and James McAvoy and Christopher Plummer did a perfect job of representing my novel. You know, I was there on the set. I talked to each of them about their character. It was to me a kind of a hallucination to suddenly appear on the set and to be sitting in this Tsarist-era railway carriage with Helen Mirren dressed up as the Countess Tolstoy. I really thought I had stepped back into history. It was so realistic. And, you know, being an author of this thing and having dreamed it up, it was like having a waking dream.
And actually, it was Helen Mirren whose character, I thought, while everything else was very, very close to the way that it was in your novel, I thought her character, the character of the Countess Tolstoy, was the one area that I thought there was a change. And in the book, she came across to me as being more hysterical, more grotesque. In the film, I thought we were being asked to more explicitly to sympathise with her, to sympathise with her position. And I wondered what you thought of that and with whom you sympathised, her or Chertkov, in the end for the battle for Tolstoy's soul.
Oh, my sympathies are entirely with Sophia Tolstoy in this. But nevertheless, my book is fairly historically accurate. In fact, it is accurate. Everything is exactly the way it was, more or less. And she tried to commit suicide many times. She was threatening to murder Tolstoy. The number of times she actually went hysterical, she'd go off wandering in the forest, and they'd have to send peasants searching for her, and Tolstoy himself would be running through the woods trying to find her. If you did that in the film, it would be unbelievable. So, you know, that's the problem with the difference between book and film. In a film, you have to really condense, just gesture in a direction. So just a few instances of Sophia's madness was enough. We have her jumping into the pond to commit suicide only once. We cut out a scene which had been written in there at one point where she takes a vial of poison and starts gagging and falling on the floor and Tolstoy has to revive her. We took out a lot of the scenes with guns where she was threatening to shoot people. All she does in this film is shoot at a picture once. So we toned down the hysteria to make her perhaps more sympathetic than in real life she was. She was a handful.
Jay Perini talking to Sarah Crown. I love the way the scratch of pencil on notepad was used in the film to evoke the oppressiveness of a society in which every word was written down. It's a creepy sort of proto-surveillance, I felt. Tolstoy at least lived long enough to enjoy his own success, a pleasure that was denied to the Swedish author Stieg Larsson. But Sofia Tolstoy would undoubtedly sympathise with the trauma that Larsson's life partner, Eva Gabrielsson, has suffered since his death. She gave an exclusive interview to Rachel Cook for Sunday's relaunched and expanded Observer Review, and it makes compelling reading. With me to discuss it are Will Skidelsky, the Observer's literary editor, and Rosie Swash, Guardian music writer, and a die-hard fan of the girl with the dragon tattoo. Welcome, both of you. Will, this is a very sad story, isn't it? Will you just fill us in a little bit of the background?
Stieg Larsson and Eva Gabrielsson met at an anti-Vietnam rally in the early 70s, and they lived together for 32 years. But unfortunately, they didn't get married because in Sweden, if you get married, you have to publish your address. And because Stieg Larsson was a sort of crusading anti-fascist journalist, there were sort of genuine fears about attacks to him and his family. And so, and in fact, according to Eva in this interview, you know, there were a couple of attempts made on his life. So they didn't get married for, you know, purely for those arbitrary reasons, really. And as a result, he died of a heart attack, age 50, having written but not yet published his Millennium Trilogy. You know, surprisingly to Eva and his family, they went on to become, you know, the biggest bestseller since Harry Potter, making over 30 million pounds worldwide in sales. And because she wasn't married to him and he hadn't written a will, the estate went to his father and brother.
Oh, dear. It's sort of your worst nightmare, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, what's interesting about the interview is, in a way, she says she doesn't care about the money. It's not the money she is sort of wants. It's the way that it's basically the way that, you know, these people who she says that Stieg Larsson wasn't actually very close to have now kind of gained control of what happens to the work, and she hates the way she talks about the way he's become mythologized and so on and so forth. And
This is quite a familiar story, isn't it? I mean, last week in Review we had the story of Emily Dickinson and the dispute over her estate, and it's as much over the content and the literary legacy again as it was about any sort of hope of financial gain. It always strikes me as really, really sad. Why does it happen so often?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, it's a classic sort of, you know, all these different sort of things involved which you can't really compare it with against each other. You know, your love for the person, your desire to do the right thing by them in a sort of literary terms as the executor of the work, and then the money as well. So I mean, it's a sort of all these sort of things that can't be measured against each other. I mean, you know,
it's Wagnerian, isn't it? You could say it's Wagnerian, and indeed the Wagners are involved in one of them themselves and have been for generations. Now, Rosie, one of the things that has been contested by Gabrielsen is the quality of the translations.
She feels
that the English translation has been prettified. Do you see evidence of this?
Well, there's evidence in the title change. The title of the first book in the trilogy is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the original title in Swedish was Men Who Hate Women,
which
obviously a little bit less marketable, although I probably still would have read it. And I think that's probably what she's talking about, is he had a very clear agenda. It's subtle in the books, I feel, in that he wanted to explore violence against women, institutionalised sexism. And it's interesting, considering the legacy since his death and what's happened to Gabrielsen, that his message was always women should fight back. And I guess that's what she's trying to do. She's trying to fight back and say, I was there with him when he wrote these books. This isn't how he would have wanted them to be portrayed, particularly with something like the title, because The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo totally put me off as a title. I did not want to read it. I just thought, that sounds awful.
Now, Rachel Cook is quite sceptical about the books. She says, among other things, the first book, which is also the best of the three, has the most boring opening 50 pages of any crime novel ever written.
True.
Do you agree with this?
Yeah, 100% agree. I started reading it about a year ago, and I just thought, what is this? It's really corporate. It's about this family that I guess are the Scandinavian equivalent of the Murdochs, and one of the pages is dedicated to a family tree. And obviously also because all the names are Swedish, you just think, oh, it's so impenetrable. And my sister said, you've got to bear with it. It's so good. You get to a point and you won't be able to put it down. And my mum said the same thing, so I took it away this Christmas and forced myself to get through it. And then I actually, when we were flying back to London, I was walking up the stairs to the plane reading it, because I just couldn't put it down. So there's definitely a point that you have to get to where it becomes gripping. But he's a very, very detailed writer. There's lots of things that happen in the book that you're waiting to know why they're there. Why is it? And it's got no relevance to the central plot. And he really likes to give his characters a lot of layers. But I really enjoy his writing style. It's very clean, probably because he was a journalist and then became a fiction writer, so it's not, he hasn't got a sort of flowery prose style.
Although rather amusingly in the piece, that all these sort of aspersions cast even on his writing, and lots of people say he was such a terrible writer. You know, as a journalist, his copy needed so much editing that he can't have written these books. You know, it must have.
Well, some people
have had a lot of help.
Gabrielsen must have.
Yeah, although she denies
that. Yeah, so I don't know, but they're still good. They're still good.
There's also a suggestion that there are 200 pages of an unfinished manuscript sitting somewhere, maybe
she's
in the,
holding on to them
in his computer, which he's holding,
and the family want the computer.
Custody of his computer.
It's that's lots a new one.
And apparently they said, we'll give you his apartment if you give out hand over the computer.
Yeah,
although she hasn't now got the apartment, but she didn't get the computer. But I mean, I wonder if you've seen the film.
I have seen the film. Yeah, I went to the press screening about a month ago.
Me too. Because I don't know if you'll agree, but I thought it was. I think Rachel's criticism of the books are completely right, but actually I thought the film was so well done, because it was the book with all the sort of pointless digressions and all this pointless sex in a way as well, kind of cut out.
Yeah.
So I thought it was actually much.
Can sex ever be pointless? Yeah.
Well, it really is in. You know, the way that Blomkvist, every woman he, you know, comes across, half an hour later they're in bed. It just always seemed like too much of a sort of wish fulfillment on Stieg Larsson's part.
And
but in the film, they've
you know,
done,
he obviously just
that.
Thought, I, you know, I'd like to think, rather than creating this James Bond character, what he actually thought was, if I create in Blomkvist a totally understanding a male protagonist, he is a feminist himself, he treats women with respect, he's not domineering, maybe that, he's trying to say, maybe that is incredibly attractive to women. Or maybe he just wanted to live out some kind of fantasy, I don't know. But the other thing about the film is, by removing a lot of what's happened in the book, they change the plot quite a lot. They change which character does this thing, and I'm trying not to give any of it away. And I don't know how Gabrielsen feels about that, but I actually really enjoyed it, because I thought they still clung on to the point.
I didn't think it suffered.
It didn't matter,
I mean,
there were
certain simplifications. I mean, it would have to be, because it is such a complex plot. But the kind of the core of it was all there, and I thought it was very.
And there's a moment where Lisbeth Salander and Michael Blomkvist are going off to begin the pursuit of this family mystery, and she's googling something on her laptop, and she just said, "Why is it whenever you Google a woman's name, you get porn sites come up?" And that's not a line from the book, but it goes to show that whoever wrote the screenplay totally understood the point that Larsson was trying to make in his characters.
Now, you'll have to wait a little while to see this film. Meanwhile, going back to the Observer, Will. It's not the, this is not the only big literary story that you're carrying in this launch edition, is it?
Well, no. Andrew Rawnsley's long-awaited book, The End of the Party, which is his account of the whole New Labour story right up to the present day, is we're running over 2 weeks, 21st and the 28th, we're running a very long extracts from the book.
That's a very big commitment to a single book, isn't it? Two whole editions.
It is, but although, you know, I can't say anything, we've been sworn to secrecy.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't. I mean, it's so secret that only one person, I think, you know, the editor of The Observer is the only person who's been allowed to sort of see a copy.
It's under Harry Potter rules. It's coming out of the warehouse at 10 o'clock on Saturday night.
But the revelations in it are you know, explosive. So
this is an example of a book that could actually move the political landscape.
Well, one very possibly. I mean, you know, If it says certain things about Gordon Brown, maybe it will hinder New Labour's chances in the next election.
Do you think that The Observer's bucking the trend by beefing up its literary coverage, just as so many other papers are cutting theirs down all over the world, really?
Well, it is. I think the decision the paper has taken is that not just in literary coverage, but in cultural coverage and indeed our political coverage, we're becoming a bit more serious, a bit more slimmed down, but more reflective, more serious, and so.
But not slimmed down in the books pages.
No, absolutely not. No, we're the books pages are bigger, and our cultural coverage as a whole is being expanded. So, you know, our intention is to be more serious.
Well, you'll just have to wait until Sunday to make up your own minds about the new expanded or slimmed down, whichever version we're taking of it, Observer. On Saturday, meanwhile, The Guardian will carry a review of Robin Robertson's new collection, The Wrecking Light. And if there's a more fulsome tribute this year, I'll tattoo a dragon on my arm. Here is a taster.
Abandon. That moment when the sun ignites the valley and picks out every bud that's greened that afternoon. When birds spill from the trees like shaken sheets, that sudden loosening into beauty, the want in her eyes fleet blue, the metals of light on water, the way the water intrigued about her feet, the ocean walking her out into its depth, sea lighting the length of her, from the narrow waist to the weight of the breasts. The way she lifted her eyes to me and handed me back, simplified. That moment at the end, knowing the one I had abandoned was myself, edging with the sun around the bay's scoop of rocks, rolling the last gold round the glass. That shelving love, as the sun was lost to us, and the sky bruised, and the stones grew cold as the shells on the beach at Naxos.
Robin Robertson, reading from The Wrecking Light. Sarah Crown joins me now to discuss the collection. Sarah, Adam Newey, in his review of this book in Saturday Review, makes the distinction between a poet who writes about nature, which he says Robertson is, and a nature poet, which he isn't. Can you unscramble that for me?
Yeah, I think so. It's something that I think has come up, particularly in the UK, a lot less so in America in the last, say, half a century, that we've managed to come up with a sort of a negative sense of the term nature poet. It's kind of like it has implications of sort of lots of poems about flowers, kind of endless iterations of Wordsworth's daffodils. And it feels a bit pretty and a bit tame, which is possibly something to do with our prettified, tamed landscape in the UK, because in the States it still has it's a much grander tradition. They have a lot of nature poetry in the States, and everyone's very happy with that designation. But poetry of the natural world here is still absolutely kind of recognised as an interesting thing to write about, and particularly among Scottish poets, I think. And Robin Robertson was born in the north of Scotland. He was born in Aberdeen, and a lot of what he said in sort of interviews and things in the past, that the landscape really informed him as an author, as a human being, I think. And he always returns to it in his poetry, and, you know, having moved away and then, you know, sort of moved around, it became something in his head once he, you know, it was thrown into relief by his absence from it. And it's the landscape to which he returns in his writing. Mm-hmm. And it's not about, these aren't descriptive poems. They're not just representations of
nature.
So it's not
it's not impressionist writing,
exactly.
Is it?
No, it's not. It's expressionist. Mm. It's about sort of looking at the natural world, much in the way that John Burnside does, for example. He looks to nature for moments of grace and stillness and sort of epiphany. And Robertson does much the same thing. He uses nature as a sounding board, and he takes from it and gives back to it. And it's a reflexive relationship. It's not just description.
Mm. Now, there's one poem I was very taken with, which is Signs on a White Field, in which he talks of, he says, frost heave has jacked up boulders. You get a real sense of the impacting nature of nature, don't you? I mean, that could be almost frost heave.
I was going to say.
Could be Gerard Manley Hopkins, couldn't
it? Yeah, or Robert Frost, actually.
Or Robert Frost.
It has that kind of that meatiness, that bitiness, and nature, sort of, you know, not to kind of go down the tooth and claw avenue, but more that it's a sort of roiling, rolling, pummeling kind of nature that he's talking about. And again, I think it is interesting and important that he's a Scottish poet. He's coming from a landscape that is much more of that type than, you know, someone coming from the Midlands would be. You're not going to come up with that kind of description about the countryside around Kettering, for example.
I think we'll probably get lots of complaints from Kettering imminently.
With apologies.
Is this collection a breakthrough for him, or is this what he's been doing for ages and we just haven't known about it?
Well, I think, it depends what you mean by breakthrough. In the poetry world, poetry field, perhaps, to use a more Robertsonian description, everyone knows about him. He's the only poet in the UK to have won every category of the Forward Prize. That it's divided into three categories: best collection, best first collection, and best individual poem. And Robertson's won all three of them. He's been nominated for the T.S. Eliot Prize. You know, he's really a big name. He's edited by Don Paterson at Picador, and he's very much kind of part of that sort of the real top flight of British poets.
He's also an editor in his own right.
He is an editor.
He?
Yes. He's an editor of fiction, and has had an extremely lucrative and interesting career as an editor. And he's also a translator. He's translated Euripides. He's a Renaissance man of British literature, I think. But he's you know, in poetry terms, he's famous, really. If you mean more, is this going to be a breakthrough for him in terms of general readership? That's kind of a different question. He's not Caroline Duffy. He's not writing about love. It's not something that's marketable like that. He's not Christopher Reed writing about bereavement. It's not something that people who aren't interested in poetry or don't have any, you know, sort of pull towards poetry are necessarily going to go out and buy. This is serious, you know, literary poetry. But if you want to go and buy a collection of poetry, I think it's a wonderful collection. And, you know, you think of people like Seamus Heaney, another very serious poet. He has a general readership, so perhaps there's hope for us yet.
Well, as you know, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, we on The Guardian are always urging you to read more poetry. To find out, Sarah especially, actually.
Yes.
to find out more about Robin Robertson and Stieg Larsson, please do read The Guardian Review on Saturday and The Observer on Sunday. You can get both books from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Also in The Guardian on Saturday, for budding writers among you, we'll be asking a whole range of literary stars for their top 10 writing tips. Definitely one to cut out and keep. You can download the next instalment of the Book Club podcast too. If it isn't already on your MP3 player alongside this programme, it's available at guardian.co.uk/bookspodcast. And you can hear Peter Carey talking to John Mullen about his novel Oscar and Lucinda. That's all for now, though. Thanks to Jay Perini and Sarah Crown, Will Skidelsky and Rosie Swash. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Scott Corley. Until next week, goodbye. Thank you.